Hello there, and welcome to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. I'm Rick Moore, along with our producer and engineer, Bill Proposky, and of course, Josh Arnold. That was Renee and Joe. We have a little local music on here as often as we can, gleaned from unfinished music, which is heard twice a month with Greg Verga. On Wednesdays, live music by local performing artists, local musicians, and great to have them on. This is a program we try to put on most Fridays, but boy, with schedules and stuff, it's not always easy to do that, but we'll be heard most Fridays at 10 a.m. from 10 to 11 here. And mostly talking information show. And hello there. What you got?
Well, we have David Rattigan, the writer, producer, and comedian on first. And we have Paul Lundberg, who's a city councilor of Gloucester, following him.
All right. So we've got that coming up in just a minute here. This is Trending Now. You're listening to MSO News Sports. .com, as it were. I almost forgot who we are here. All right, we'll be right back. And we're also known as MSO Radio. Okay, we'll use that one too, MSO Radio. We'll be right back.
This is Connections on MSO News.
Score early and often this fall with a low-rate residential loan from the Institution for Savings. The Institution for Savings has fantastic rates, low or no fees, great service, and prompt turnaround. Plus, we service our mortgages in-house, so help is always a local phone call away. For more information or to apply online 24/7, visit institutionforsavingsloans.com. Or call us at 978-462-2344. Institution for Savings, member FDIC and DIF, equal housing lender.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. If you're thinking of replacing the windows in your home, you should look at the Anderson Woodwright double-hung insert window, which comes with rich wood interiors in oak, pine, or maple. Quite simply, Anderson is the most trusted window in America. That's why we've been selling them for 57 years. Please see the Anderson Woodwright windows on display at any of our three locations in North Reading, Beverly, and Plastow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan, and today I'd like to speak to you about the North Shore Student Athlete Program. Sponsored by Moynihan Lumber in conjunction with the Salem News, the Daily Item, the New Report Daily News, and the Gloucester Times. The program, now in its 24th year, celebrates high school students who excel not just on the playing field, but in the classroom as well. Male and female winners are chosen each month. All student athletes must be nominated by their coaches. Nominations for the program are made via email to nsstudentathlete@gmail.com. Youngsters who are nominated must have a B average or better. Monthly winners are then eligible to be selected as Student Athletes of the Year. Yearly winners and their families are recognized at a luncheon at the Salem Country Club held in early June. Please remember, all youngsters playing a varsity sport at any high school on the North Shore, public, private, or parochial, are eligible.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our first guest is writer, producer, comedian David Rattigan. David, welcome to the program.
Hey, Josh, how are you?
Well, I'm doing well. Usually start out and ask folks to do the short bio and tell us a little bit about yourself. So why don't you start there, and then we'll go on from there.
All right. Well, let's start with this. I grew up in Beverly. I was an extremely advanced child. I was driving by age 5, and my life has been a smooth path ever since. Now, I'm a comedian. I was a journalist for a long time. I guess I still am a journalist. I shouldn't say I'm not a journalist anymore. But my day job, I write for a couple of different entities, including the Boston Globe. And then at night, I'm a comedian. I tell jokes, and I also do a little teaching at the community college up in Northern Essex Community College. So I'm pretty busy.
Yeah. What do you teach?
Yeah. I teach interpersonal communications and public speaking.
That's great. That's great. I remember taking a public speaking course in, well, that's a story for another time. But anyway, I took a public speaking, a couple of speaking classes at a community college, and I was running late out the door to college, and I grabbed a name of an author off a book and used it in my debate, if you will, and the professor called me on it, and he went to his office and he said, D. Fedotoff White, what did he actually write about gambling in New Jersey? And I said, actually, he didn't write anything about gambling in New Jersey. He says, yeah, he wrote Survival Through War and Revolution in Russia in 1917. He said, I wanted to lay that one on you because if I catch you here, if you get caught here, you won't do it again when you go to state school or wherever you're going after this place. So,
right.
It was
right.
Good. It was a good one. You know, so sometimes you can bluff it, and sometimes it doesn't work that way. But anyway, moving on. What?
I can't believe you were bluffing, and we use the term bluffing because we can't use any other term. Your way through community college.
That's very unusual. It was a debate, and I was just running late to college, and I hadn't, you know, I was a good speaker anyway, so it was kind of like I needed something to fill in, and, you know, I was going to ace it anyway, so, you know, what did it matter? But anyway.
Well, was it a good lesson for you? Did you learn? Did you not do it again?
I did not do it again.
Yeah.
I did not do it again. Yeah.
One of the things I tell my students is there were two confidences. There are two issues of confidence that can derail you as a speaker. One is to not have enough confidence, and the other is to have too much.
Too much, yeah, yeah.
And the speaker with too much confidence who doesn't do the work tortures us, you know, in many ways, tortures us because we've got to listen to him.
Yeah.
And the same with the speaker who doesn't have enough confidence to speak. So that's really what I find, at least, is that sort of the key to the class is to get people confident enough to deliver their best work. But also, if they're, you know, for those who are prone to trying to skate through, it's, you know, you want to get them to do the work so that they're actually coming, they're actually communicating themselves to be as intelligent as they are.
Yeah.
As they say. But anyway, let's talk, what do you want to talk about, comedy?
Yeah, I mean, comedy, anything. I was watching a rerun of Johnny Carson flicking channels the other night, and he had Raquel Welch on. He had Jay Leno and Raquel Welch, I think, from one of the 1980s shows. And he said, he asked Raquel, her daughter was in entertainment. He said, a lot of people in the entertainment field do not encourage and actually discourage their children from getting into the entertainment world because of all of rejections and how difficult it is. So having said that, how hard has it been for you to work in the entertainment field as a comedian? And what's it like, you know, building up to, you know, going from club to club or nightclub to nightclub or audience to audience? And what is it like when you get up and nobody laughs?
Well, you know, I'm very familiar with that. less familiar. The longer you do it, the less familiar you get with that. But you know, you have to be tough in
yeah.
this business. It's the actual time on stage tends to be really, really enjoyable. Which is the reason we all do it, because the business itself is kind of a grind. I mean, even when you're making fairly good money, there's travel, there's pressure, there's you know, there's a lot of rejection. You know, even for the guys who at the level above me and the level above them, there's a lot of rejection. It's sort of all the same thing, but just on different scales. You know, people decide that you can do something or you can't do something based on your look or the kind of haircut you have or your age or your skin color, and it's very arbitrary. And I think that's why that's why I think people who are in show business, and again, there are plenty of people who are in show business who you see somebody who's an actor, and their kid becomes an actor, but you also see somebody who's they're an actor and their kid becomes a camera operator or a tech person, or,
yeah,
something like that, because you know, they love the business, they just hate the business of the business, so to speak.
Sure.
And that's, you know, that certainly happens. You know, and I think with comedians, the funny thing that we deal with, or one funny thing we deal with, is that people sometimes feel like when they meet a comedian, they're supposed to be funny. And some people aren't that funny.
Yeah.
And first of all, they put unnecessary pressure on themselves in some cases. And other times they people insult you without maybe realizing how insulting they're being. I had a friend of mine, I won't tell you who, but he's a very successful comedian, and he was hired to do a corporate event for a company, and the next year they called him back, and the same guy who had hired him said, yeah, the people on the committee wanted to have you again this year. I didn't really want to have you, but everybody else did. it's just like, and I won't tell you what the comedian said because it's inappropriate.
Yeah.
But he reacted kind of negatively to that, and you know, I still think about the situation, think about the conversation, having heard it secondhand, and I don't know if the guy was just trying to be funny, or if he was just overanalyzing and being a little too honest.
Yeah.
But you know, but what a thing, you know. Hey, listen, I don't want to hire you for this, but would you like to come do it?
I had a experience. We had, when I was in educational administration, we had two assistant superintendents who left the district to go become a superintendent in other districts, and so they gave them a roast. And the first one was funny, and people, you know, I was the business guy, so people were in awe that I told jokes or could tell jokes or any of that. The second time we did it, I got off a couple about the current superintendent, and he did not like it, and he let me know. And guess what? That was the last roast we did for a long time. In fact, I think that was the last roast they did as long as I was there. And yeah, you know, getting back to when you're up in front of the audience, I know if you're doing a reading at a wedding or a reading in church, and you come upon a word that you're, usually I'd know everything before I went in, but people will come up and they'll lose their place for a split second. They take their eye off or whatever, look up and look down, and they can't find their spot. And you're in the congregation, and it's only a matter of seconds. But when you're the person who's doing the reading, it seems like a week went by. What's that like for a comedian? I mean, Johnny Carson would tell two or three jokes and nobody laughed or nobody moved, and he would have the, you know, the comebacks like, oh, you're going to be one of those kind of audiences, or, you know, I thought the bad audience we had last night was bad, but you guys are, or he'd start to the band would start to play music and he'd start to do like a little tap dance. What are the things that you do or other comedians do to segue off of those kind of things?
Well, there's two situations I think we're talking about. One is when you forget something, either a bit of your material. I mean, we have material. Sometimes you'll do a bit every single night, and then all of a sudden you'll go blank. Or
yep,
more likely, you have a bit that you've done 5-10 years ago. You still bring it back once in a while, but not often. And you bring it up and you just say it wrong. And then the other part, of course, is just you know, when the joke doesn't land, or when the audience is kind of awful. You know, a lot of times in our audience, so last night as an example, I do a show in the summer. We do it every Thursday. I'm there most Thursdays up in York, and there's Lobster in the Rough, which is a little place in York, Maine. And it's a Thursday night show. We did the first show of the season last night. We had a fairly light crowd, and they took a while. They took a while to warm up, and you know, when you have a small crowd, they tend to feel a little, you know, they can take a little while to get going because they're a little self-conscious that there are so few of them, and you don't have that critical mass, and you don't have the 100 people might have 10 really good laughers in them, but one of 10 people and the crowd is just 10 people, then you're down to one person who's a good laugher.
Yeah.
And, I mean, percentage wise, it might be two of 10, 3 of 10, but you know, there's always the person who laughs loudly who kind of helps carry everybody else. You know, people get a little less self-conscious, and that's part of the psychology of comedy is, you're next to somebody who's laughing, and they're next to somebody who's laughing, and they're next to somebody who's laughing, and pretty soon you're all laughing together. So it's a communal energy, and sometimes you don't have that energy up front. So if it's early in the night and they're not going, you don't necessarily want to pull that out too quickly.
Yeah.
Because if you reference too quickly that things aren't going well, you know, you might make them even more self-conscious. On the other hand, if you let it go too long, you run the risk of, like, you know, you're doing your material like everything's fine and there's nobody laughing, and you're ignoring the elephant in the room, so to speak.
Yeah.
So it really becomes a touch and feel kind of thing.
Sure.
You know, when do you reference it, and you know, when do you reference it, and how do you not do it too often, which is the big.
Which leads me to ask the question. What do you do? Do you notice? I'm guessing you do. When the person laughs out of turn, and that's like the person who got the joke, but you're already on to your next joke when they start to laugh, and they're a loud laugher.
Yep.
How do you play that?
It's all touch and feel.
Yeah,
all touch and feel. You're up there. And if they're laughing and they distract you, and a lot of comedians, here's a little tip, inside tip for all your listeners, a lot of comedians have ADHD. a lot of them do. So it becomes it's really easy to get distracted.
Sure.
There's so many distractions, whether or not there's an event or, like, for example, we do the Cruiseport show every year for the Gloucester Rotary. See how I'm working this in here? I'm working in a little plug for that show. It'll be, again, the Thursday before Labor Day. But that's a really nice crowd, and it's a big room. But if something happens in that room, it's an interesting room because you can pretty much hear everything going on in the room when you're on stage. And that's the way it is at a lot of comedy clubs. So you'll be at a place. I did a function, a corporate thing for a company, and they were this was not at Cruiseport. This was in Newport, Rhode Island recently. And, you know, I'm on stage, and they're serving dessert. And it wasn't my choice to be on stage that early, but they were running late, so they had to move me up, so they put me on during the dessert. And I don't know if you've ever been on stage while they're serving dessert, but there's a lot of clattering and clanging and this and that. And it was also a place with wooden floors and a loud bar, and it's just noise, noise, noise. It's a little bit like when you have a 2-year-old and you're on the telephone. So you will seize on the telephone and want your attention multiplied by, you know, 100, 200 people. That's a lot of 2-year-olds. So that's what the early years of comedy do. They toughen you up for the later years because you deal with, you know, a lot of good gigs that pay really well. You know, you run into the same things. You know, you're in a comedy club and the waitress drops a tray. You know, bang, try to ignore that. And it's the same thing when somebody laughs out of turn.
Yeah,
something comes up, it gets your attention. It depends. If it knocks you off the joke, if it interrupts the joke, maybe you want to double back, maybe you want to drop the joke. But it's really a touch and feel thing that you learn. And you're not always right. I mean, there are times that I've thought, oh, yeah, I can go back and finish this bit. And then the bit kind of lays there. The momentum's been interrupted. The other thing we run into that goes similar to your comparison to the reading and losing your place is forgetting a name.
Yeah.
And this happens more than we'd like to admit. But you're introducing the next comedian, or you know, you're hosting a show and you're let's say you're introducing the next comedian, whatever the situation is. I had a friend, and you just blank. And it's happened to me. It happened to me last night. I introduced a guy by the wrong name, and I caught myself, and then I had to redo it. But it was pretty awful, and it's only the second time I can think of doing that in my career.
Just tell me it was your Ed Sullivan impersonation. I watched Johnny Carson with Rich Little, and they were talking about Ed Sullivan, and Rich Little says, "Yeah," he said, "I got introduced by Ed Sullivan." He said, "I'm introducing a really upcoming," upcoming comedian. Everyone's talking about a Mr. Buddy Rich. and then of course Johnny steps in and says, "Yeah, Ed just couldn't get a name right," and you know, he was well known for that, and you know, he'd get up and he'd draw a blank and just say, "Well, here she is," and someone would come out and sing, you know, and
it's always I didn't know Ed Sullivan, but there's a lot of times just there's a million things going on, and it's the thing you don't think about.
Yeah.
You know, I know when we give introduction, you know, we'll give introductions to people, you know, when a comedian gets introduced, there's a certain way that is kind of the best practices way of introducing a comedian. And the key part of it is that you say the name last. So, you know, you tell people something about what he or she has done, and then you say the name and people clap and you get a little momentum, and that's.
Politicians have been known to fudge things at times, and you know, there's the famous quote during the bicentennial celebration when President Gerald Ford remarked, remembering the words of Paul Revere, "One if by day, two if by night," instead of "one if by land, two if by sea." But anyway.
The same version, different setting, same story.
Politics is what's going on with politics and humor. Johnny Carson in his day was one of the premier people. Bob Hope too, and they would just rattle them off one after another. They fed off of Watergate. Comedians are trying to. Do stuff with the incumbent president, and some of them are not succeeding, and of course there's some tasteless things that have happened, but what's your sense? Do you stay away from the incumbent president, or do you fire one out when it's...
Me personally, I'm apolitical for a couple of reasons. On stage, and one of the big ones is that the crowds right now are so divided.
Yeah,
live crowds that, I've seen this happen over the years where most comedians who are political, they take one side or the other. Like a Jimmy Tingle, who's fantastic if you're a liberal, and I think he's still great if you're a conservative, but maybe conservatives would not feel the same way. But he gives you a very, very liberal slant. Very funny. He gets you there in a beautiful way. Really, really a strong writer. But you know, he's a liberal Democrat, and most crowds are split these days. And
so you get half the room is ready to laugh, the other half is ready to punch the other half out.
And they're a lot more polarized. Where you think to yourself, well, why can't you just laugh? You know, why is it that you can't laugh at yourself or laugh at your belief system or laugh at your people? And I don't know why, but people don't. And it, I don't know. You know, in my head, I think that this is different than it used to be.
It is.
But I mean, it seems to be to me, but I'm, you know, maybe I'm not drawing on a...
No, I see it. The polarization is to the third power from what any other election has been that I've seen, that I've witnessed in my time here. Milton Berle was the... they used to say of him, Uncle Milty, he never heard a good joke he didn't steal. And they... in the old days, I know from talking to you that comedians would share each jokes with each other and, you know, swap, and because you were making the circuit, it didn't make a difference if you used someone else's material. But it's not that way today. Tell me about that.
Well, I think that really goes back to about the 80s where they were, I guess, and this is, again, this is what I'm being told. I don't know it for a fact, but I think when around the time the 80s came in and you had that new wave of comedians kind of ushered in by Carlin and Richard Pryor. I think they became a little bit, but it was also the age of television.
Yeah.
You know, the age of television. The television was up, and people, back when they were giving each other jokes, they weren't going to be seeing it. You know, they weren't all going on TV, and people weren't going to see it. And so you couldn't. So around the 80s, I think people started kind of claiming the jokes, and it was sort of like, well, if you do it on TV before I do it on TV, then it's your joke. But now it's like it's online, and you see things and people. I mean, I have a friend in New York, and she had a great joke. It was a Kathy Griffin Trump joke, and it was actually a very funny joke. Don't anyone get offended, but they're talking about Kathy Griffin, and after what she had done holding up the severed head, the bloody severed head of the president, which, you know, we talked about, and yeah, a lot of people felt that was tasteless, and so she posted something that said basically, you know, that's just the way we girls talk in the locker room.
Yeah.
A reference, obviously, to Trump.
Yeah.
You know, this is locker room talk. And so it got a lot of play. And then the next thing, somebody put it on a meme, didn't give her credit for it. Her name's Kristen Seltman. And they didn't give her credit. They posted it on a meme. And then whoever it was who posted it was going to take full credit for the joke. Now, was it independent thought, or did she see the joke and think, hey, that's really funny, and put it on? You don't know. I mean, I've seen my stuff put into memes. I've seen Brian Kiley, who's one of the, he writes for Conan O'Brien. He's a Boston guy, one of the best joke writers there is. And, you know, I've seen his stuff, which is brilliant, which has been published in GQ's list of the 75 greatest jokes ever told. And I've seen that same joke taken and just repeated on a meme with no attribution. And, so I think the rules have changed because of media. And, like I said, around the 80s, I'm, you know, my timeline is the 80s. People became more protective of their material, and then first it was television was the big driver. Now it's all media everywhere, and it's very tough to say, again, you know, which is the joke that, you know, you and I both happen to think of the same joke because it was. We were thinking of the same thing in the same way.
Yeah.
And what it is that, you know, what's happened where one person has written a joke and somebody else hears it and they think, hey, that's good. You know, and then there's the unintentional plagiarism, which is where you work with somebody, you don't realize later on that you're writing the same joke that they wrote.
Yeah.
But you're still plagiarizing. So, it's a tricky world. And I would also add that there are some people who get very sensitive to the idea that everybody's stealing their material, when in fact it's just that their material is just, you know, not quite as
unique,
you know,
as they thought it was.
Snowflake that they think it is.
Yeah, well, the man who got no respect, Rodney Dangerfield. I you shared a story with me offline about interviewing him. Share that story with our listening audience, please.
Sure. I was writing a story when I was living in New York. I was writing for National Magazine. So I was writing for the Robb Report, and the story was on comedians who are paid giant money when they work, but also would show up at comedy clubs to do free sets and to work cheaply in the city as a way of working on their material. And so one of the guys that I interviewed was Rodney Dangerfield, and he owned Dangerfield at the time, but he was spending most of his time in L.A., and he was very well known for stopping at clubs and doing material. So I talked to the folks at Dangerfield. They set me up. They said, Rodney's going to call in at, let's say, 8 o'clock. So 8 o'clock rolls by, and I've got my phone all set up, and I've got a little recording device that's plugged in, and... 8 o'clock rolls by, and then 9 o'clock rolls by, and then right around 10 o'clock, I get a phone call. And by this time, I've given up. But the phone rings. I run into the bedroom, which is where I have the thing set up. and I pick up the phone, and it's Rodney, and I'm fumbling to get the recorder right, and I pull a cord, and out comes the cord, and I hang up on him. And I'm thinking, I've just hung up on Rodney Dangerfield. And I'm thinking, I've just lost this interview, which is key to my story. So I plug the thing back in, and I get everything straight, and I hope he's going to call back. And the phone rings again, and it's Rodney. And he says to me, he says, just in that Rodney voice, he goes, "What a way to start a relationship."
That's great.
And then it was a great interview. So it was it was nice, and it was a good story. And I have actually, I think somewhere I have that on tape, because at this point, I started the tape recorder before he, as soon as the phone rang, I hit the record button.
We got to go, but I before we part and go to our next guest, tell us the joke you shared with me earlier this week about the Viagra Cialis commercials.
Oh, the actual joke or
the one that you said was the best one, that one of the better ones that you'd heard.
Yeah, I'm still. How about this, Josh? I'll plug my show and then you tell me the joke, because I don't remember the joke. I know a couple of Cialis.
Well, it was the kid says, "Dad, your show's on."
Oh, well, that's a Paul Gilligan joke.
Yeah,
Gilligan, who's a fantastic comedian out of Ipswich, tells a joke about every time the Cialis or the Viagra commercial comes on the television, his kids just say, "Dad, your show's on." And that's the joke, which would have been good if we had set it up properly.
Yeah.
I didn't remember which joke. Can I plug a couple of shows?
Sure.
Hampton Beach Comedy Festival, which is in Hampton Beach every year. Jimmy Dunn and I are doing it, along with Lenny Clark and a bunch of other great comedians. That goes July 20th till July 23rd. So anybody who would like to go to that can go to HamptonBeachComedyFestival.com or look it up on Facebook. Or go to scampscomedy.com, which is the name of my company. And then later on in the summer, we're going to have Jimmy Dunn again going to come in, and he's going to be with Kelly McFarland and Dan Crone and myself. And we're going to get Andrew DeFranzer. I don't know if you've ever had Andrew on your show, but Andrew's an affordable housing advocate, works for or heads up Community Partners, and he's going to be coming in to do a special guest spot in front of all those nice people in Gloucester. We do it every year. It's benefits the Gloucester Rotary. It's at Cruiseport, Gloucester. It's the Thursday before Labor Day weekend. And Ruth Pino is the point person. So you can pick up tickets from any Rotary member. Anybody who listens to this should go to that show. Thanks for letting me get those plugs in.
That's great. Thank you. And thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Certainly appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule, and remind me when we talk later. I've got a book of newspaper articles to share with you.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Josh.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Hi folks, this is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. If you're replacing the windows in your home, please see the Anderson 400 series windows on display at any of our three locations in North Reading, Beverly, or Plaistow, New Hampshire. The Anderson 400 is attractive, durable, energy efficient, and reasonably priced. Remember, Anderson is the most trusted name in windows. See the Anderson 400 at any of our three locations. That's North Reading, Beverly, or Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Harrington's Trophy and Awards has been rewarding the North Shore for over 25 years. Hi, I'm Kevin Harrington.
And I am Marty Harrington, and we are known for our local family business, providing custom trophies, plaques, screen printing, embroidery, and much more. We offer a variety of services such as engraving wedding gifts, medals for charity walks, youth sports trophies and uniforms. From the newest style performance wear to your everyday work shirts, we are your one-stop shop. Whether it's a fantasy football, warm-up suits for your team, end-of-the-year banquet gifts, or recognizing excellence, we pride our business on our exceptional customer service and quality products. Located in Lynn, or visit our website at harringtontrophy.com.
People come in, take a seat. You're really in for a treat at Sylvan Street. A great place to eat and drink and meet with family and friends at Sylvan Street. We treat you right, day or night. Satisfy your appetite. Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
Catch a game with friends, meet for lunch, cocktails after work, or a romantic dinner for two. Whatever your plan, plan to do it at Sylvan Street Grill in Peabody and Salisbury. See you at Sylvan Street.
Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our next guest is Gloucester City Council Councilor Paul Lundberg. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Josh. Good to be with you.
I know we've had you on in the past, certainly when you were running for re-election last time. But for those of in our listening audience who may not be familiar with you, would you just give us the bio and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Thank you very much for the opportunity. Yes, well, I'm a Gloucester native and spent most of my working career in the railroad industry in Chicago. Came back to Gloucester 17 years ago. Got involved with city government, was on the planning board for 6 years and 2 years as the chairman. Was still working, so I was on the road a lot. But when I finally got off the road 4 years ago, I thought that I would like to take the next step in working for the city. And so I ran for city councilor at large, which is in Gloucester. We have five wards, and each one has a ward councilor, and then there are four at-large seats. And I think we had a field of six or seven in that first election that I ran in. I came in fourth, so I became a city councilor at large. And then the last election cycle, I ran for re-election, and the same thing. We had eight candidates. This time I came in first, and now I'm running for re-election this fall, and I hope to be able to persuade the voters that I've done a good job, and we'll continue to do a good job for them.
Great. You served two terms, essentially, now on the city council, and they're two very different city councils in some respects. Tell us about that. How is one different than another? How were the challenges the same, and how were they different?
Sure. Well, the first time around, I think I was the only newcomer on the council when that election happened. This last time, there were five newcomers elected to city council, and there were only four of us who were incumbents. So that was a huge change. Change is great, and the newcomers, what they lacked in experience, they certainly made up for with their energy and their interest in serving the city. And so we've had a whole different debate this time around about challenging, conventional wisdom, if you will. And I certainly welcome that, and I'm glad to have them all on board. We'll see what happens this next time. The ward councilors, four of them are unopposed, so they'll be back. Ward 2 has two newcomers running. And so far in the at-large race, we have nine people have taken out papers. So we could remake the city council again.
Okay. What do you find to be the most rewarding and fulfilling parts of being a city councilor in Gloucester?
Sure. I think one of the things that it's important to point out in terms of our structure of government our city, we have, the mayor is elected, the mayor serves as really the city manager. So she actually runs the city. All the department heads report to her. The city council is the legislative body. We get to review and approve the city's budget. We do not get to manage the city. That is the mayor's job under our city charter. And so I think one of the challenges for councilors, especially newcomers, is where is that line drawn? How much influence can they have on affecting what the various departments like DPW and fire and police do, as opposed to just advising the mayor? I think that as with in most instances, people kind of find their own way, and a nice relationship develops. So I think that we have found that equilibrium with the mayor, and we really don't have too many differences of opinion, but we do have a lot of input, and she welcomes that.
There's a lot of different planning documents that are authored by different folks. We have a community development plan, you have a harbor plan, you have a capital improvements advisory plan, tourism plan. How often do these things get updated? How update are our plans, and what, if anything, is in progress to update them in either a timetable or ways that the public would participate in those updates?
Right, and we have another plan. We have the housing production plan, which was which is done in accordance with state law. And that is to analyze the amount of affordable housing a particular city has. And if you are under the state-mandated 10% of your housing stock be affordable, and there's all kinds of definitions about that, then you have to produce a plan on how you're going to get to the 10% if you're not already there, which we are not. We're at about 7% affordable. So that's another plan. Good question about these plans, Josh. They exist, and they are right now in various stages of discussion. People, refer to them when they refer to a particular issue. We have yet to develop a cohesive strategy in the city on how to implement all those various plans that you mentioned and how to move forward. So right now they're there, and we have not yet had a specific initiative to do that. Part of that is we've had several community development directors in the last 2 years, and now we're looking for another one. And so that's probably the job in the city that would coordinate the implementation of these plans. We just haven't had that continuity. Hopefully we get a talented person for that job, and we can get some action on these various plans.
Brief follow-up, the role of the community development director is defined in the charter, and there's a lot to that between the city charter and what's written in the city ordinances. So I guess maybe the question I'm wondering is, You said we've had a number of different community development directors.
Correct.
I'm wondering why that is, and I'm wondering somebody who comes in from outside of Gloucester, may not live in Gloucester, may not have worked in Gloucester.
Right.
Is there a big learning curve to get acclimated to the city, and is that part of the problem? Do we not pay enough money? Is the job too complicated? Do we not staff it? Is there a sense of why there's such turnover in that position?
I think the main sense is that some of the incumbents that we've had in the last 2 years have just gone on to new jobs. I know that Tom Daniels, who was with us for about 18 months, he had originally been the assistant city planner in Salem, and when the Salem top job came up, he of course wanted to go back to Salem, where he was from. Then he was succeeded by Dan Smith, who really has more of a transit procurement background, and then he got a job opportunity in Washington, D.C., so he went off. So it's hard to say that that there's anything inherently wrong with the job. It's just that, you know, when you try and recruit talented people, they have more opportunities. And to answer your second part of your question, yes, there's a huge learning curve, obviously. We want someone who is knowledgeable of Gloucester, and as you know, being a Gloucester native, that can be tough if you're not from here.
Yeah.
So, it's going to be the job of the mayor when she picks somebody and is successful in getting a good candidate to make sure that person becomes community familiar and that she opens all the doors for that person so that that person knows what the lay of the land is.
One of the oversight areas for the community development director is engaging and working with the Capital Improvements Advisory Board, and that has taken a kind of an oblique turn in the last few years. There was a point where Constantine Malescus, going back to when he did it, with Don Fricklin, Mike Fahey, Paul Meneves, any of those, and they were a really hands-on group. During the Kirk administration, there was a sense of it becoming more of a rubber stamp board, and they weren't as actively involved. It was simply the administration would put a plan in front of the Capital Improvements Advisory Board, and they would approve it or not approve it, and so forth. So now that the CIAB is seemingly hard to staff, and so all of the capital projects that come before the council don't go through a Capital Improvements Advisory Board, which the charter says we're supposed to have. Any sense of how that all gets straightened out along the way?
Yes. Well, I mean, you accurately characterized the kind of the history of that board. I've always been a big fan of it as an institution because I think that's a great place for citizen input. Current administration feels that it's important. I think they have other priorities ahead of it, so they haven't really put their muscle behind it. Now that the mayor's budget is passed and that's over with, hopefully that we can get that back on track and energize that board. We have huge capital needs. One thing that the current administration did do that's a positive is take the free cash flow, which the previous administration just threw back into the budget, and has allocated it now to several funds, including a capital development fund. So now, if we have free cash, some of it goes into that fund. But we have huge issues. We've got two more elementary schools to do at some point. And we have a public safety building to do at some point. And we don't have a plan as to how those all line up in terms of timing. And of course, there's also a move afoot to enhance or replace some of the library. So there's a big job to do. And I think that I'm encouraging the mayor to put some energy behind that right now.
Well, I assume when you say when the mayor established a capital fund and put free cash, that you guys were looking at the quote that stands behind you when you're on the dais at City in the Kairos Hall. Build not for today alone, but for tomorrow as well.
That's right. We were trying to look at that. And you know, the press of city business sometimes overcomes the strategic planning part, but it's the strategic planning part that's going to make the city great, and I think that we just have to find a way to do it.
I remember interviewing Dean Cushing years ago, a former city manager in Gloucester, and for a paper I was doing in college, and he said, you know, I could be out doing all kinds of, grandiose things about bringing a new industry in here, doing something that will create more jobs, greater income. But push comes to shove, you know, part of city government is who's going to clean out the catch basin, who's going to fill the pothole. There's a lot of day-to-day stuff, and there's no trade-off. You have to do it all, and it's doing it's fixing the locomotive while it's still going 60 miles an hour. So sometimes, you know, it doesn't all come out the way it's designed on paper, but in the end, you find a way to make it work.
Right. Now, I like your railroad analogy there.
It's really
hard to fix the locomotive when it's speeding down the track. But that's the challenge of city government is to how do you do the day-to-day stuff, which is all consuming, and still have time to put a thoughtful plan together. The city deserves a lot of credit on how we put together the funding for the West Parish School. And that whole process, that worked well, and the city, the administration was able to structure the borrowing and ultimately the structure of the debt in a way that is friendly to the budget. They did a good job on that, and we just have to start thinking about these other projects, but we got to do it.
Yeah.
That's a good theme for the campaign, too. Probably one that I'll be mentioning.
Lots have happened over the years about the Fuller property. It's nobody's cutting the grass there, not the city and not the YMCA. Know that we signed a purchase and sale agreement. Where are we with that?
There's a consortium that involves the Y, Wendover, Sam Park, and the housing portion, Dolben. They have put together a plan. They have gotten the first of the city special council permits, which is the changing to create a zoning overlay district so that all those competing interests can reside in the same zoning area. So that's been done. The next step is for them to come back to the city with their master plan and their major project application. The holdup there is their requirement that as a developer with the developer of housing at 200 units is required by city ordinance to provide 20% of those units be affordable as under the state formula or make a contribution to the city's affordable housing trust. They have said that they want to make the contribution to the trust because they want all 200 units to be market rate. We have encouraged them that they should come back to us with a major project, not just with a proposal to contribute money to the trust fund, but to have a plan as how units get built. The trust fund itself is not a housing developer. It doesn't develop affordable housing. It can help pay for it. And so we've encouraged the developer to, when they come back with their major project application, to have as part of that a specific plan on how 30 units get built somewhere else in the city. And that's what we're waiting for. We're waiting to hear back from them.
The project is scoped as presently to have 200 units?
200 units, yep.
So what is the impact that is likely to have on the other services, be it schools, fire, police, safety, or DPW?
Probably not much of an impact, I think. I don't know for sure, but I'm thinking that the impact on the schools is going to be negligible. Probably not a lot of school-aged children going to be in those families. Even if they are, we have a slightly declining school population right now. So
I noticed the graduation, and I was, wow, a lot has changed since we were in school.
Yes, there was. When we were in school, we had 350 graduates, and this time it was less than 200. So there's a changing demographic. I think the impact of 200 new units, if their marketing assessment is correct and they can fill them, is going to be a positive for the city. There's a lot of taxes, and there's a lot of revenue for businesses.
Okay. Is the financing on this project such that the parties that collaborate need the revenue from a market rate units to do the other things that are supposed to happen there, or is that not a dependent variable? And maybe you can't answer that.
I don't have any inside knowledge on that. My guess is that for the all the parties to purchase the Fuller School site from the city, they need to have the revenue from the apartments. The Y, you know, they could probably stand alone somewhere. They want to be there.
Yeah.
But they've partnered with those others because they want to be part of that. So it's hard to say whether, you know, part of the issue of the Fuller School site is the remediation of the site, tearing down the building, getting rid of the, you know, the hazardous stuff and all that.
Yeah.
And so any developer's going to have to pay for that. So yeah. That's, you know, they have to recoup that somewhere.
What are the most difficult decisions that the city council has to weigh and make during the most recent budget process?
You know, I have to give the administration credit and that they did come forward with a budget that addressed the management issues that we are usually interested in. You know, do you have too many people? Do you have too much stuff? They did a pretty good job of getting out ahead of that. So when the City Council Budget and Finance Committee, of which I'm an alternate member, you know, did department by department, line by line, the whole budget, and found that, you know, it was a pretty well thought out budget. So, there weren't any particular challenges, you know, for us there. Some of the challenges, Josh, are on the revenue side. That's really where, you know, we're dependent on certain variables. Our property tax is pretty steady, but the monies we get from the state under Chapter 70 and 90 for the schools and for roads and stuff, that's variable depending on the state budget. And then one of our big sources of income is the beach parking. That's over $1 million a year, and that's weather dependent. We have a lot of good summer weekends. We make a lot of money at the beaches, and when we don't, we don't. So there are some variables that we hope come true in the way that the mayor did the budget.
When I was the operations manager of the schools, we put a proposal together. We had our food service program take over the beach concessions, and that was 15 years ago. More than that, but anyway, they closer to 20, and they on a 90-degree day, you do 20 years ago $5,000 in volume gross sales.
Yep.
In the beach concession. So, right. Move that ahead 20 years, you can see, you know, how, you know, what a revenue generator that is. You had a couple of minutes left. Going forward, what are going to be the challenges for the next city council? What are we going to be talking about, you think, in the election cycle coming up?
We are going to be talking about a couple of things. We're going to be talking about affordable housing. We now have this housing production plan, which the state will certify, and that requires the city to come forward with an actual action plan for making it easier to construct and add affordable housing. So we're going to be dealing with that. And you know, the reason for that is that when you're under the 10% threshold under the state, a developer can come in and develop properties as long as they have a certain number of affordable units without going through all the permitting processes of the city. So that's a challenge for us. We are going to we've got a couple of other, you know, really, the recreational marijuana situation is very fluid right now, and the bill that just passed the House gives the cities and towns a lot more authority to approve or deny recreational retail outlets. That's something that is going to be a huge issue for us in the coming months. So there's a couple items right there that are going to, you know, be serious substantive issues.
Great. Well, I want to thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Wish you the very best in your upcoming campaign for a third term on the City Council. And as we get into the election cycle, we hope to have you back.
Great, Josh. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you, Paul.
Goodbye.
All right, it is Fiesta weekend in Gloucester, and that means we've got sports events coming up tonight on MSO News Sports. It'll be the women's Seine Boat races and the first of the Greasy Pole walks tonight, and it's going to be an interesting event for spectators. Astronomical low tide tonight during the Greasy Pole walk. It's a long way to the bottom.
Long fall down.
You got that right, man. It's going to be something, and we wish everyone nothing but good luck and good health. It's a really dangerous sport, and we'll be broadcasting that live streaming video tonight starting around 4:30, 4:45. Bill Newell, me, will be on the mics, and Andrew DeCastro, Alex Sanfilippo will be on the cameras, and should be a spectacular event tonight. We'll be covering events tonight, Saturday night, and Sunday night as well from the Gloucester St. Peter's Fiesta celebration. Meantime, some of the guests you're trolling for?
Well, actually, a number of people we've reached out to, but next week we will have Susan Wernick on as our first guest for a half an hour, and we have City Councilor from Lynn on second, Mr. LaPierre, and we'll have Dave Gardner, who will be sworn in the night before as the district governor for Rotary for 47 clubs north of Boston.
All right, that's Josh Arnold, our producer and engineer, Bill Proposky. I'm Rick Moore. See you later. Thank you.